You have the truth, but do you have the zeal? There are those out there who don't have the truth, but have the zeal. We have to counter that with our own zeal because we do have the truth. And then consider the perspective of your child. I don't think we do this enough. It's hard to live the faith if you don't know how. And have you taught your kids how? You have to teach them how. They have to see it in your example, and you have to nurture them in this. And we're going to get into that a lot. I use the analogy of sports. That's where I'm going to get into because I'm a nut. Alrighty. Anyway, I'll leave that to later. But briefly, have you taught them how to live the faith, how to experience the faith? In the wonder of the Mass, for example, it's hard to be a Catholic child that lives in a world that is full of skepticism, that is attacking the faith, is attacking the church in every one of its teachings, is calling the church bigoted because of its stance on whatever, especially on the sanctity of marriage right now. They need to understand that the church is a refuge for them in the midst of all these attacks, and they can come back to you. And it would be foolish to let them think that they can get this from any place other than you. So invite them to live the quest. Live the adventure of the Christian life. And if they perceive no passion in you, they see nothing to strive for in their life along that way. There's a poem that Stoddard Kennedy did. He was a chaplain in the First World War. Did a lot of good for soldiers back then. But in looking at sort of the Christian life back then, this is 1914, 1915, he wrote a poem that's called Indifference, which is, I want us to look at this and listen to this and say, is this the way my house is? Now, he writes about it in the context of Christ coming to Birmingham, England, okay, in the 20th century. This is how the poem goes, but apply it to your family life. When Jesus came to Golgotha, they hanged him on a tree. They drove great nails through hands and feet and made a Calvary. They crowned him with a crown of thorns. Red were his wounds and deep. For those were crude and cruel days, and human flesh was cheap. When Jesus came to Birmingham, they simply passed him by. They would not hurt a hair of him. They only let him die. For men had grown more tender, and they would not give him pain. They only just passed down the street and left him in the rain. Still, Jesus cried, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." And still it rained, the winter rain that drenched him through and through. The crowds went home and left the streets without a soul to see. And Jesus crouched against the wall and cried for Calvary. We can't be indifferent in our homes to Christ. He has to be thick in the air. It has to be part of our daily life. So you must be the one, you, Father, must be the one with the passion and enthusiasm for the faith so that you can be the one to communicate the passion, the enthusiasm for the faith. Now let me give you some thoughts here. In considering the matter, I thought a lot about, I was struck by the success of St. Jose Maria in founding Opus Dei. I'm a member of Opus Dei, and so I looked to him a lot for examples of my life. And he founded Opus Dei in 1928 when he was 26 years old, and it took 5-6 years before, you know, men started to join him in really what was an extraordinary thing. But these were not older men. These were men who were half his age by the time they're joining. And he continued this apostolate of young men, of high school and college kids, well into his 40s and 50s. And I looked at this, and he inspired men to make a radical Christian commitment to their faith and to live genuinely Christian lives in the middle of the world in an environment framed by the Spanish Civil War. And I looked at it, and what was the key to that? How did he do that? And the answer is friendship, a genuine friendship based on true love. You can hear it in this inscription he wrote in a book to a young architecture student. When I made you a present of that life of Jesus, I wrote in it this inscription: may you seek Christ, may you find Christ, may you love Christ. These are three very distinct steps. Have you at least tried to live the first one? And in this, in the inscription, you can see the love that he has for the recipient, grounded in his love for Christ. Those young men he befriended sensed the love and friendship, the love which engendered the true friendship that he had for them. And this is the same starting point for us, is developing genuine friendship with our children so they will accompany us in the journey. They will want to be part of the quest. If you look at Sam and Bilbo, is that, those the right names?
Yeah.
Sam, yeah.
Frodo.
Yeah, I knew I was getting it wrong. Okay, Sam and Frodo. If you look at that whole quest, that whole thing, it's an amazing example of friendship. And I'm going to go through it here, but I want you to think of it in the context. What true friendship really is, what true love is. And look at it again with the context of seeing it in terms of love. The Nicomachean Ethics, which is an Aristotelian book, which is an amazing work of pagan literature. I mean, it really is. My gosh, this, had Aristotle been in the time of Christ, I think he could have been a great saint. But anyway, what in a mind. But in it, he talks about friendship. And one of the things he says is, perfect friendship is the friendship of men who are good and alike in virtue. For those wish well alike to each other, and they are good themselves. Now, those who wish well to their friends for their sake are most truly friends. For they do this by reason of own nature and not incidentally. Therefore, their friendships last as long as they are good. And goodness is an enduring thing. So, you know, we can see in that that the foundation for true friendship and the friendship with our kids is going to be in our virtue and the virtue that we develop in them. I have another quote from the Nicomachean, if I can find it, that I want to give to you, which I thought was really good. And think about this in the context of Sam and Frodo. Now, friendship depends more on loving, and it is those who love their friends that are praised. Loving seems to be the characteristic virtue of friends, so that it is only those in whom this is found in due measure that are lasting friends, and only their friendship that endures. It is in this way, more than any other, that even unequals can be friends, father, son. They can be equalized. Now, equality and likeness are friendship, and especially the likeness of those who are like in virtue. For being steadfast in themselves, they hold fast to each other, and neither ask nor give base services to the other. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. So let's consider what love is. Love is an act of the will. It's not an emotion. It carries with it certain emotional aspects. I mean, you know, of course, it's not an emotion. It's an elemental reality of love, that it's an act of the free will. It's a choice we make. And it manifests itself in three ways. A desire for the greatest good for the person who's the object of our love. A willingness to sacrifice self and give self to and for the person who's the object of our love. And third, a desire for union with the object of your love. Those are three very important considerations. Consider them in the case of God and God's love for us. A desire for the greatest good for the person who's the object of our love. What is the greatest ultimate good? You can answer. God. Duh. Alrighty? Nothing's better than God. He's the greatest ultimate good. What does God want for us? For us to be with him. He wants him for us. A willingness to sacrifice self and give self to and for the person, Christ. A desire for union with the object of your love, the Eucharist. You see how our Lord has given us the premier example of love in each one of those ways. Consider in the case of your wives, your love for your wife. What is the thing you want most for your wife? Should be. Heaven. Alrighty. What are you willing to sacrifice and give yourself for your wife on her behalf? I sure hope so. And for our children, of course. A desire for union. We want to be with our wives. We want to be with our children. And in the case of our wives, that union is manifested in a beautiful union in marital intimacy. Okay? That's true love, okay? When it's done out of love, for the good of, and as a self-sacrifice. Wife, you know, just because the nature of men, we tend not to be as giving as surrendering. You know, women tend to surrender the love of men willingly. Men more likely impose themselves, on their love on, or their passions on a woman. But we have to have this sense of surrendering or giving self in the intimacy of our life, in our married life. And consider the case of Sam and Frodo. A desire for the greatest good for the person. Each time they went through, you know, some issue, they were hoping for the greatest good. They would sacrifice each other himself, and they wanted to be with each other. One of the heart-rendering moments in that movie is when Frodo decides to leave Sam, and Sam comes running after him and nearly drowns. Yeah. It's a beautiful, that desire for union is very palpable. And so that the friendships are developed through spending time and sharing common loves and passion. Again, 2,000-year-old writings here can give us some instruction. Again, if I can find it. Friendships require time and familiarity. As the proverb says, men cannot know each other till they have eaten salt together. Nor can they admit each other to friendship or be friends till each is found lovable and been trusted by each. Those who quickly show the marks of friendships to each other wish to be friends, but are not friends unless they both are lovable and know that fact. For a wish for friendship may arise quickly, but friendship does not. It all takes time. So, you can't share a passion for faith unless you are yourself are passionate for it. All right. These are nice principles. How is this done? Well, let me offer you a pattern, a framework, one way of looking at this that really struck me with my own family life. I was visiting my son. He was at Stanford undergrad, my number four son, for Parents Weekend up at Stanford. And it just so happened that the U of A very nicely was playing Stanford that week in the football game. And so we went to it as part of our liturgical commitment. And while we were there, in the third quarter, all of a sudden, Stanford starts getting the best of the U of A, and the U of A ends up losing the game. But what ends up happening is that somewhere in the middle of the fourth quarter, I get a text from my son who's at NYU in New York, and the game wasn't actually telecast. And the text says, "This is killing me. I used to want them to win for you, Dad. Now I want them to win for me." Okay? And I got that text and I said, he bought into it. He bought into being a fan of the U of A. And that, it was like one of those wonderful, wonderful moments where you go, oh my goodness, okay. So then I started to think about this. Well, hold on. How does this work in the context of the faith? What have I done for him in making him a fan of the U of A football that maybe others can learn from? And what have I done? And has that translated in what I've done to him for the faith? And maybe others can learn from. So how many of you here have big sports fans that, you know, your kids you follow teams like, you know, the Cowboys or the Texans or something like that? You guys, okay. You guys have other passions. How many of you love golf and have your kids love golf? I mean, do you share these passions with your kids? I mean, do you have some of these things where you guys share these things? You know, whether it's driving motorcycles or whatever it might be. I don't know, you know. Don't go there. You know, any hobby or something you have a passion for that you share with your kids. And, you know, you've imbued your kids with a sense of that enthusiasm, that fandom, if you will, in that thing. Well, let's look at what happened to make that happen in the context of sports and then use that as a pattern for our duties as fathers regarding the faith. And, in fact, this whole sports analogy has been validated by St. Paul, who often likened his struggles in the faith to running a race, you know, to a boxing match, you know, as an athletic competition. So I think St. Paul must have been a jock. And I've always been taken by his beautiful poetic finish to the second letter of Timothy. For I am already being poured out as a libation, and the time of my departure has come. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. In the future there's laid up for me the victorious crown of righteousness, which the Lord, just judge that he is, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have longed for his appearing. So you get the sense here, running the race and all that. So I think this is legitimate. By the way, Thomas Aquinas also has a commentary in the Summa about, you know, the good of sports, because it's a basis for people to come together and to join in a common unifying principle.